The year my grocery bill jumped so high it made my stomach knot, I knew something had to change. It wasn't just the prices. It was the empty shelves, the feeling that I was one bad week away from not having fresh food for my family. I grew up watching my grandfather pull potatoes from a patch of ground. He tended like gold. Back then, I thought gardening was a hobby. Now, I understand it was insurance. My first attempt at a backyard garden was a mess. The soil was more clay than dirt. The weeds grew faster than my lettuce. And after a summer of sweating and swearing, I ended up with 3 sad tomatoes and a handful of limp carrots. I almost gave up. But one night, scrolling through videos of old-timers and homesteaders, I kept seeing the same thing: raised beds. Neat wooden boxes full of rich, dark soil. No weeds. Healthy plants. And people grinning like they'd beaten the system. So I started reading, asking questions, and saving up for lumber. What I found wasn't just a better way to grow vegetables. It was a way to take control. A 4x8 raised bed isn't magic, but it gives you the upper hand. Good soil, less bending, and a clear plan for what to grow where. It's not about chasing some magazine-perfect garden. It's about putting food on your table with your own 2 hands. This is the story of how I built mine, mistakes, shortcuts, and all, and why I'll never go back to planting in the ground. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 1. Why I switched to raised beds. When you rely on grocery stores for every bite you eat, you don't think much about where food comes from. You just assume it will always be there. That illusion cracked for me during one spring when the produce section looked stripped bare, and the little that was left cost more than I'd ever seen. I stood there staring at bruised apples and wilted lettuce, calculating how much less fresh food my family would get if I stuck to my budget. That's when the old voice of my grandfather came back to me. If you can grow your own, you don't have to ask anyone for permission to eat. I'd tried to grow a garden before. I tore up a patch of yard, tossed in seeds, and hoped for the best. By midsummer, I had a mess. The soil was stubborn clay, hard enough to bend a shovel. Rainwater sat on top instead of soaking in. Weeds took over faster than I could pull them. I planted in rows like I'd seen in farm fields, but the plants looked miserable. By August, I had almost nothing worth eating. That first attempt taught me one thing. A bad setup will beat good intentions every time. The idea of raised beds kept showing up in my research. At first, I thought they were more for people who wanted a pretty garden, but the more I learned, the more sense it made. Raised beds aren't about decoration. They're about control. Control over your soil, your drainage, your layout, and your harvest. The more I compared my failed patch to a raised bed setup, the more I realized I'd been fighting battles I didn't have to. A raised bed is basically a box you fill with the best soil you can get. For a 4x8 bed, you can stand on any side and reach the center without stepping on the soil, so it stays loose for roots. The height means no bending until your back aches, and weeds are fewer because you're starting with clean soil. That's not just easier on your body. It's a huge advantage if you're serious about feeding yourself. I started planting mine in late winter. I knew my budget was tight, so I began looking for materials. Most advice I found said cedar was the best wood. It resists rot and can last years without treatment. But cedar is expensive. Pine is cheaper, though it won't last as long. Some folks even used reclaimed lumber, but I had to be careful about chemicals. Treated wood lasts forever, but it can leach toxins into your soil. If you're going to grow food you'll put in your mouth, you don't want that risk. A neighbor of mine had built his beds with pine and lined the inside with a thick plastic sheet to protect the wood from rot. I liked that idea, affordable and practical. I priced out both cedar and pine at the local lumber yard. Even with the plastic lining, pine would save me almost half the cost. That mattered. If I could get my first bed built without breaking the bank, I'd still have money for compost and seeds. The size was the next decision. There's a reason 4x8 feet is so popular. It's big enough to grow a decent variety, but small enough to manage. You can reach the middle from both sides without stepping in the bed, which keeps your soil from compacting. Plus, the boards come in 8-foot lengths, no complicated cutting for the long sides. Before I could build, I had to choose where to put it. A garden bed is only as good as its location. You need at least 6 to 8 hours of full sun for most vegetables. I watched my yard for a few days, noting where shadows fell at different times. The south side of my property got sun almost all day, and it was close to the water spigot. Important when you're hauling a hose in July heat. Once I picked the spot, I cleared the ground. I mowed the grass low and pulled any stubborn weeds by hand. You don't have to till or dig for a raised bed, but you do want a fairly even surface so your box sits flat. I laid out the lumber in a rectangle to visualize the space. Seeing that empty frame on the ground made it feel real, like I was taking the first step toward not depending on anyone else for fresh food. That's when it hit me. This wasn't just about gardening. This was about building something my family could rely on if shelves went empty again. A raised bed doesn't care if the trucks stop running or the store runs out of lettuce. Once it's built and filled, it's yours. I called an old friend who used to do carpentry and asked if I could borrow a circular saw. He laughed and said, "You're finally doing it?" He remembered me talking about wanting a better garden years ago. We cut the boards to size, and I bought heavy-duty exterior screws to hold them together. Some folks use nails, but screws are easier to adjust if you make a mistake. The assembly was simple. 2 8-foot boards for the long sides, 2 4-foot boards for the short sides. I clamped each corner before drilling to keep it square. You don't need fancy joinery. Just make sure your corners are tight and the boards sit flush. I added corner braces inside to keep the box from bowing once it was filled with soil. Standing the finished frame in place felt good. It was solid, sturdy, and ready to become something more than wood. I lined the inside walls with thick black plastic, stapling it along the top edge. This would slow down rot in the pine and give me a few extra years before the wood needed replacing. Before filling, I laid down cardboard over the grass inside the frame. This is a trick I learned from another gardener. It smothers weeds and grass but breaks down over time, adding organic matter to the soil. Some people use landscaping fabric, but cardboard is free, biodegradable, and does the job. By then, the sun was dipping low and the air smelled faintly of cut wood and earth. I stood there looking at this simple box, thinking about what it would hold. Food, yes, but also peace of mind. If you've ever been in a position where you didn't know how you were going to make ends meet, you know how much that matters. I didn't fill the bed that first day. That's a whole job on its own, and one I wanted to do right. But just seeing it there, built and ready, felt like a small victory. This was no longer a vague plan or a Pinterest dream. It was real, sitting in my yard, waiting for the soil and seeds that would turn it into a food source. Looking back, the switch to raised beds wasn't just about getting better harvests. It was about taking responsibility for what I feed my family. When you build it yourself with your own hands, you remember every screw, every cut, every decision that went into it. You know exactly what's in the soil. You know the plants will be healthy. And you know that, no matter what happens in the world outside your gate, you've got a patch of ground that works for you. Next came the fun part, filling it with rich, living soil that would give my vegetables the best possible start. But that's a story for the next chapter. Chapter 2, picking the right materials. When people talk about starting a garden, they usually jump straight to seeds. What to plant, when to plant it, how to space it out. But here's the truth. If your raised bed is built with the wrong materials, you'll be fighting problems long before you ever drop a seed into the soil. I learned that lesson by watching a neighbor's beds literally fall apart in less than 2 seasons. The boards warped, the screws rusted, and the corners gapped so badly that soil leaked out with every heavy rain. I didn't want to make that mistake. Once I had the frame size in mind, 4 by 8 feet, I needed to choose wood hardware and protective materials that would last. And because my budget wasn't unlimited, every choice had to balance cost, durability, and safety. The first decision was wood type. Walk into any lumber aisle and you'll see options. Cedar, redwood, pine, spruce, and the pressure-treated stuff that builders use for decks and outdoor stairs. On paper, pressure-treated lumber looks tempting. It's cheap, it's resistant to rot, and it can last for decades. But here's the problem. It's treated with chemicals to keep bugs and fungi away, and those chemicals can leach into your soil. For a deck, that's fine. For food crops, it's a risk I'm not willing to take. That narrowed it down to 2 practical options, cedar and pine. Cedar is naturally resistant to rot and pests. It smells good, cuts clean, and can last 10 to 15 years outdoors without much maintenance. The downside? Price. Around here, cedar costs almost 3 times what pine does. For one bed, that might not break the bank, but I knew I'd eventually want two or three, maybe more. That made cedar a luxury, not a starting point. Pine is the budget-friendly option. It's soft, easy to cut, and widely available. Untreated pine will last about 5 years in direct contact with soil, sometimes longer if you protect it. That's where lining the inside comes in. I decided early on that I'd use pine for my first bed and extend its life by stapling a thick plastic liner along the interior walls. The liner doesn't touch the soil directly at the bottom. I leave the base open for drainage and soil life, but it acts like a shield between the wood and the damp soil pressed against it. Once I'd picked my wood, I moved on to thickness. Thin boards will bow outward once the bed is filled, especially after heavy rain. A 1-inch thick board might seem fine when it's empty, but load it with nearly a yard of soil, and it starts to flex like a cheap folding table. I went with 2x8 boards for strength and depth. The 2 in 2x8 means they're about 1.5 inches thick, sturdy enough to resist warping. The 8 is the height in inches, which is enough to hold a healthy layer of soil while still being easy to reach into. Hardware was the next decision. You can hold a bed together with nails, but nails loosen over time as the wood expands and contracts with the weather. Screws hold better, and if you ever need to make repairs or adjustments, you can remove them without damaging the boards. I chose galvanized exterior screws. The coating resists rust and keeps them from staining the wood. For each corner, I added a metal brace inside the joint. These aren't strictly necessary, but they help keep everything square and prevent the boards from spreading apart under soil pressure. Then there was the question of corner posts. Some gardeners build their beds by attaching the boards directly to thick corner posts that stick a few inches above the sides. These posts make it easier to stack additional boards later if you want more height. I decided to skip them for now, since my liner method meant I'd be rebuilding or refreshing the bed in about 5 to 7 years anyway. But if you plan on keeping the same bed for a decade or more, corner posts are worth considering. The last piece of the materials puzzle was what to put under the bed before filling it. You can set a raised bed directly on grass, dirt, or even concrete, depending on your yard. On bare ground, most people add a weed barrier to stop grass and invasive plants from creeping up. Cardboard is my go-to. It's free, biodegradable, and thick enough to smother weeds while allowing worms and microbes to move through as it breaks down. I gathered large boxes from a local appliance store, cut them open, and kept them dry until I was ready to lay them in. That covered the basics, but there were a few extras I considered. Some gardeners install hardware cloth, a type of stiff wire mesh, at the base of their beds to keep out burrowing animals like gophers or moles. I don't have those pests in my yard, so I skipped it, but it's worth adding if you've seen signs of digging near your garden. Another optional extra is a drip irrigation system, which runs water slowly and evenly through the bed. I decided to wait until I'd planted my first crops to see if I needed it. Shopping for the materials was almost as satisfying as building the bed itself. There's something about stacking boards in the back of a truck and knowing they'll soon be part of something useful. I picked through the lumber pile carefully, checking each board for cracks, knots, or warping. Straight boards are worth the hunt. They fit together more cleanly and make a sturdier frame. By the time I got everything home, I could picture the finished bed in my head. The pine boards would weather into a soft gray over time. The screws and braces would hold it tight through storms and heat, and the liner would keep it in service long enough for me to get years of harvest from it. One last choice remained: finish or no finish. Some gardeners apply a natural oil, like linseed or tung oil, to the outside of the boards to slow weathering. I decided against it for my first bed. Oils can help, but even the food-safe ones can be questionable if they leach into the soil. Since I was lining the inside, I figured the outside could age naturally. Looking back, picking the right materials wasn't just about buying the right wood or screws. It was about setting myself up for success. A raised bed is an investment, not just of money, but of time and energy. If it falls apart after 1 or 2 seasons, you've wasted all 3. With the materials chosen and stacked neatly in my yard, the next step was the most satisfying: turning that pile of boards and screws into a frame that could hold a season's worth of life. Chapter 3, Building the Frame. There's a moment in every project when the talking and planning stop, and the real work begins. For me, that moment was standing in my backyard, tools laid out on a folding table, boards stacked in the grass, the air cool enough to smell the pine in the wood. The frame wasn't complicated, four boards and a handful of screws. But it was the backbone of everything to come. Get this part right, and you've got a solid structure that can last years. Rush it or cut corners, and you'll be patching and repairing before your first season is even over. The first step was checking my tools. A good build isn't just about the materials. It's about having what you need ready to go. I had a circular saw, a cordless drill with a charged battery, a box of galvanized exterior screws, two clamps, a carpenter's square, and a tape measure. The square was especially important. Without it, corners can drift out of alignment and your frame will end up twisted. That might not sound like a big deal until you try to fill it and the boards start to pull apart under pressure. I laid the boards flat on the grass, pairing the 8-foot lengths for the long sides and the 4-foot lengths for the short sides. Even though I'd checked them at the lumber yard, I still eyeballed each one for straightness. If a board had a slight curve, I made sure the curve bowed inward. The soil's weight would help press it back into shape. Assembly started with the first corner. I set one short board against the inside end of a long board, edges flush. A clamp held them in place while I drilled pilot holes. Skipping this step is tempting, but driving screws directly into the end grain without a pilot hole can split the wood, especially in softer pine. I drilled two holes per joint, then drove in the screws, letting the drill do the work instead of forcing it. The sound of the bit biting into the board was clean and solid, a good sign. With one corner done, I repeated the process on the other end of the same long board, attaching the second short board. Now I had a U-shape lying in the grass. The last step was attaching the remaining long board to close the rectangle. This is where the carpenter's square came in handy again. I checked each corner before drilling to make sure it was a true 90 degrees. A square frame isn't just about looks. It makes the bed easier to fill evenly and keeps the boards from twisting as the seasons pass. Once the frame was together, I added metal corner braces inside each joint. These L-shaped brackets take the strain off the screws and help the bed hold its shape when filled. I positioned them so the screws went into the thicker face of the board, not the narrow edge, giving them more grip. With the basic frame complete, I needed to choose how to anchor it. Some gardeners drive rebar or stakes into the ground at the corners to keep the bed from shifting. In my case, the weight of the soil would be enough to hold it in place, especially since my yard is fairly flat. Still, I wanted a little extra security. I cut four short pieces of scrap wood to use as inside corner posts, screwing them into each corner from the inside. They didn't add much height, but they acted like reinforcement against outward bowing. Before moving the frame into its final spot, I cleared the area again. Even though I'd mowed and pulled weeds earlier, I gave the ground another once over, raking away small stones and leveling out any dips. The flatter the base, the less stress on the joints over time. Carrying the frame into position was easier than I expected. Pine is light compared to hardwoods, and even at 4 by 8 feet, the frame wasn't too heavy for one person. I set it down where I wanted it, then stepped back to see how it sat in the space. The sun hit it from morning to late afternoon, just like I'd planned. There was enough room to walk around all sides, and it didn't block the narrow path to the shed. Satisfied with the placement, I marked the inside edges with spray paint before lifting the frame again. This gave me a guide for laying the weed barrier. I spread out large sheets of cardboard, overlapping the edges by at least 6 inches so weeds couldn't slip through. For stubborn edges that curled, I weighed them down with bricks until I was ready to set the frame back in place. With the cardboard in position, I lowered the frame over it, lining it up with the painted guide marks. The fit was clean, the board sitting flush against the ground with no wobble. I pressed down on each corner to make sure it didn't rock. The last prep step before filling was lining the inside with the heavy plastic I'd bought. This wasn't a full liner covering the bottom, just the walls. I cut the plastic into strips the height of the boards, leaving an extra inch at the top to fold over. Using a staple gun, I attached the plastic along the inside walls, spacing staples about 6 inches apart. The plastic sat smooth and tight, with no gaps where soil could press directly against the wood. This step would slow rot and keep the bed functional for years longer than unprotected pine. When I stepped back and looked at the finished frame, it felt solid, square corners, sturdy boards, braces snug in place, and a clean interior ready for soil. It didn't have the polished look of a store-bought kit, but that was fine by me. This was built to work, not win beauty contests. And the best part, I knew every joint, every screw, every choice that went into it. There's a quiet satisfaction in building something with your own hands. You measure, cut, fit, and fasten. And then suddenly, there's a thing in front of you that didn't exist a few hours ago. This bed was more than just a wooden box. It was a promise that in a few months, it would hold green shoots, flowers, and food I could pick for dinner. The frame was ready. The next job would be giving it the heart of any garden, rich living soil. And that part, I knew, would make all the difference between a bed that looked good and a bed that produced food worth eating. Chapter 4, Filling the Bed. If the frame is the bones of a raised bed, the soil is its heart. You can build the sturdiest box in the world, but if you fill it with lifeless dirt, you'll be staring at stunted plants and yellow leaves by midsummer. Good soil isn't just dirt. It's alive. It breathes, it holds water without drowning roots, and it's packed with the nutrients plants need to grow strong. My goal was to create that living foundation from day one, not spend the season chasing problems with fertilizer. I started by looking at the volume I needed. A 4x8 bed, 8 inches deep, holds roughly a cubic yard of material. That's 27 cubic feet. You can buy bag soil, but that gets expensive fast. Even the cheapest topsoil bags at the big box store would have cost me more than I spent on the wood. Instead, I decided to build the soil in layers, using bulk materials where possible. The first layer was the weed and grass barrier. I'd already put down cardboard before setting the frame in place, but that wasn't the end of it. I wanted a base layer that would both suppress any stubborn growth and add organic matter as it broke down. For this, I used old leaves I'd raked the previous fall. They were brown, dry, and crumbly, perfect for starting the slow composting process at the bottom of the bed. I spread them out evenly over the cardboard until the bottom was covered in a soft, rustling blanket. Next came coarse organic material for drainage. Some folks use sticks, small branches, or wood chips here. I gathered a mix from my yard, pruned branches, half-rotted logs from the woodpile, and a few armfuls of chipped bark from a tree trimming service. This layer would slowly decompose over years, creating air pockets and feeding the soil life above it. I spread it in a loose layer 2 or 3 inches thick. On top of that, I added a brown layer, dried plant material low in nitrogen but rich in carbon. I used shredded newspaper, old straw, and a bit more dry leaf matter. This helped balance the green layers I'd add next, which would be higher in nitrogen. Building soil is a lot like building a compost pile. You want alternating layers of carbon-rich and nitrogen-rich materials so microbes have the right balance to work with. The green layer came from fresh grass clippings and kitchen scraps I'd been saving for a week. I kept the scraps simple, vegetable peels, coffee grounds, and eggshells, nothing greasy or animal-based that might attract pests. The grass clippings were still warm from the pile, a sign that they were already decomposing. I spread them in a thin layer, so they wouldn't mat down and block airflow. With the base layers in place, it was time for compost. This was the most important ingredient in the whole bed. Compost is where most of the nutrients come from, and it's loaded with beneficial microbes that help plants absorb those nutrients. I got mine from a local farm that sells it by the truckload. It was dark, crumbly, and smelled rich, not sour. I shoveled in a layer about 3 inches thick, raking it level. On top of the compost, I added bulk topsoil. This wasn't the sandy, pale subsoil you sometimes see sold as fill dirt. It was a screen top layer with a nice loamy texture. I ordered a half yard, which was more than enough for the bed. I poured it in until the frame was about 2/3 full. Then I mixed it gently with the compost layer below, blending the nutrients through the top half of the bed. To finish, I added the topmost layer, a blend known as Mel's Mix by some gardeners. Roughly 1/3 compost, 1/3 peat moss or coconut coir, and 1/3 coarse vermiculite. The compost feeds the plants, the peat or coir helps retain moisture, and the vermiculite improves drainage and keeps the soil light. I chose coconut coir instead of peat moss because it's renewable and available at my local garden store. Mixing this final layer was messy but satisfying. By the time it was spread, the bed was full to within an inch of the top, ready to settle. Filling a bed this way isn't instant gratification. You're building a layered system that will improve with each season as the lower layers break down. That's why I didn't pack the materials too tightly. I wanted space for water and air to move through, and for earthworms and microbes to find their way up. When I finished, I gave the bed a slow, deep watering. This helped settle the layers and start the decomposition process. I stood there for a while, watching the water sink in. The smell rising from the damp compost and soil was sharp and earthy. The smell of something alive. That first night, I didn't plant anything. As much as I wanted to get seeds in the ground, I knew it was better to let the bed rest for a week. This gave the microbes time to wake up and start processing the organic matter. It also gave me time to plan what would go where, so I could make the most of the space without overcrowding. One tip I picked up from another homesteader was to top the bed with a temporary mulch while it rests. I used a thin layer of straw, which kept moisture in and discouraged weeds from trying to take hold before I was ready to plant. When the time came, I could simply part the straw and plant directly into the soil. As I put my tools away, I realized this bed already felt different from my old in-ground attempt. There was no clay to fight, no weeds waiting to surge up, no uneven surface where water would pool. I'd built the soil from scratch, knowing exactly what went into it. That meant I could trust it to give my plants the best possible start, and in return, they'd give me food I could trust. The next step was figuring out what to grow first, and how to rotate crops so the soil stayed healthy season after season. That was where the planning got almost as exciting as the building. Chapter 5, Crop Rotation and Planting Plan. Filling the bed with good soil is half the battle. The other half is knowing what to plant, where to plant it, and how to keep the soil healthy year after year. A raised bed can give you great harvests in the first season, but if you keep planting the same crop in the same spot, you'll invite pests, drain the soil of specific nutrients, and end up with weaker plants. That's where crop rotation comes in. When I first started reading about rotation, it felt like something farmers with hundreds of acres did, not backyard gardeners. But the principle is the same no matter how much space you have. Each type of plant takes certain nutrients from the soil and leaves others behind. Some plants even improve the soil by fixing nitrogen into it. By changing what grows in each section of your bed each year, you keep the nutrient balance in check and make life harder for pests and diseases that specialize in certain crops. The first thing I did was group my vegetables into families. This isn't about whether they look related. It's about their biological families and how they use the soil. Legumes, beans, peas, lentils. These actually add nitrogen to the soil through their root nodules. Brassicas, cabbage, broccoli, kale, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower. These are heavy feeders and love that extra nitrogen. Root crops, carrots, beets, radishes, turnips. These need loose soil and tend to use potassium and phosphorus heavily. Fruit crops, tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, squash, zucchini. These take a lot of everything, but especially benefit from rich compost. Leafy greens, lettuce, spinach, Swiss chard. These like nitrogen but aren't as heavy on other nutrients. Once I had my groups, I sketched my bed on paper. I divided it mentally into four sections, each 2 feet wide by 4 feet long. That way, I could rotate each group through the sections over the years. My three-year rotation looked like this. Year 1. Section 1, legumes. Section 2, brassicas. Section 3, root crops. Section 4, fruit crops. Year 2. Section 1, brassicas. Section 2, root crops. Section 3, fruit crops. Section 4, legumes. Year 3. Section 1, root crops. Section 2, fruit crops. Section 3, legumes. Section 4, brassicas. After the third year, I'd cycle back to year 1. This simple pattern meant no crop family sat in the same spot 2 years in a row. The legumes fed the brassicas made way for the root crops, and so on. But rotation isn't the only planning tool I use. I also think about companion planting. Certain plants actually help each other grow when planted side by side. For example, carrots and onions make a good pair because the smell of onions confuses pests that target carrots. Basil planted near tomatoes can improve their flavor and help repel tomato hornworms. On the flip side, some plants compete or attract each other's pests, so I avoid pairing them. For my first season, I plan my sections with companions in mind. Legume section. Bush beans with a border of marigolds. The marigolds attract pollinators and help deter beetles. Brassica section. Kale and broccoli with a sprinkling of dill in between. Dill draws in beneficial insects that eat cabbage worms. Root crop section. Carrots and onions in alternating rows. The onion scent masks the carrots from pests. Fruit crop section. Tomatoes with basil and a few nasturtium plants. Nasturtiums act as a trap crop, luring aphids away from the tomatoes. One mistake I avoided from my old garden was overcrowding. It's tempting to cram as much as you can into the space, but plants need airflow to stay healthy. In a raised bed, spacing is especially important because diseases can spread faster in a smaller footprint. I followed spacing guidelines from the seed packets and resisted the urge to tuck in just one more row. The next decision was timing. Not everything goes in the ground at the same time, and planting too early or too late can ruin a crop. I checked my area's last frost date and worked backward. Cool season crops like peas, lettuce, and kale could go in a few weeks before the frost date. Warm season crops like tomatoes and peppers needed to wait until nights stayed above 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Because the bed warms up faster than ground soil, I could start a little earlier than traditional row gardeners. That's one of the hidden advantages of raised beds: better drainage and faster warming in spring. Still, I kept an old sheet handy to throw over tender seedlings if a surprise cold snap rolled in. For succession planting, getting multiple harvests from the same space, I planned to follow early crops with later ones. For example, after pulling spring lettuce, I'd use the freed up space for bush beans. When the beans finished, I could squeeze in a quick fall crop of spinach. This way, the bed stayed productive from early spring through late fall. I also built a small planting journal. Each page had the year, a sketch of the bed layout, and notes on what went where, how it did, and what I'd change next season. Memory fades, and what feels obvious in May can be a blur by the next February. Writing it down keeps the rotation plan tight and helps me spot patterns, like which spots dry out fastest or where pests seem to show up first. Once the plan was on paper, I walked outside and looked at the empty bed. It's funny how quickly you can start picturing it full. Bright green leaves spilling over the edges, blossoms turning to fruit, neat rows of carrots pushing their fronds toward the sun. But the real joy is knowing it's not just for looks. Every square foot in that 4x8 space is part of a bigger system that will feed my family, year after year, without stripping the soil bare. With the rotation and planting plan locked in, all that was left was to put seeds in the ground and see the bed come to life for the first time. And when that happened, I learned something that no book or video had really prepared me for: the way it feels to harvest food from soil you built yourself. That, I'd find out, was the most satisfying part of all. Chapter 6, First Season Lessons. By the time the first shoots poked through the soil, I was checking the bed every morning like a kid looking under the Christmas tree. The beans came first, two leaves folded over like little green butterfly wings. Then the kale and broccoli followed, their tiny seedlings looking fragile but determined. The tomatoes, which I'd started indoors, took their time settling in, but by the second week they'd found their stride. That first season was a mix of small victories, unexpected lessons, and a few hard reminders that gardening doesn't care how pretty your plan looks on paper. The biggest win was the soil. All those layers I'd built, the leaves, the branches, the compost, the topsoil, paid off. Even after a week without rain, I could dig down a few inches and find it cool and damp. The plants didn't stress in the midday heat the way they had in my old ground-level garden. Their roots had space, air, and plenty to eat. I didn't have to reach for chemical fertilizer once. The marigolds along the bean section bloomed bright and steady, and I noticed fewer beetles than my neighbor had in his bean rows. Whether it was luck or the flowers doing their job, I wasn't going to argue. The basil around the tomatoes grew thick and fragrant, and I swear it made the tomatoes taste sweeter when I picked them in late summer. Of course, not everything went smoothly. My carrots, which I'd planted next to onions, sprouted unevenly. Some grew into perfect straight roots, but others forked or stayed small. Later, I realized I'd been a little heavy-handed when mixing the soil in that section, leaving pockets that made it harder for the roots to grow straight. It was a small mistake, but one I filed away for next year. Never overwork the soil right before sowing root crops. The kale and broccoli were another lesson. They shot up quickly in the cool spring weather, but as soon as the days got warmer, cabbage worms found them. I'd seen the little white moths flitting around, but didn't act fast enough. By the time I noticed the holes in the leaves, the worms were well established. I handpicked them every morning for a week, which kept the damage from getting worse, but it reminded me that pests don't give you a grace period. You have to be ahead of them. Next year, I'd use row covers early in the season to keep those moths from laying eggs in the first place. One of the unexpected joys was seeing how much life moved into the bed. Earthworms started showing up in the compost layer within weeks. Ladybugs appeared, drawn by the dill and nasturtiums I'd planted as companions. Bees worked the blossoms on the beans and tomatoes. It was like the bed became its own little ecosystem, buzzing and rustling with activity. The harvests came in waves. Lettuce was first, tender leaves that I picked in the cool of the morning and rinsed in a colander in the kitchen sink. Eating a salad made entirely from that bed felt different than eating one from the store. I knew exactly how the leaves had been grown, down to the compost that fed them. The beans followed, crisp and sweet enough to eat straight off the plant while I watered. Carrots came next, and even though some were crooked, the flavor made up for their odd shapes. The tomatoes were the grand finale. By midsummer, their vines had climbed the stakes and started producing clusters of green fruit. The first one to ripen was small and red, warm from the sun. I picked it, rinsed it under the outdoor spigot, and bit into it right there in the yard. It was the best tomato I'd ever eaten. Not because it was perfect, but because it came from something I'd built from the ground up. Not everything I planted earned a spot in next year's plan. The broccoli took up a lot of space for a small yield, so I decided to swap it for more kale next season. The onions did fine but didn't store as long as I'd hoped, so I'll grow them in larger quantities in another bed once I have more space. But the beans, carrots, lettuce, and tomatoes? Those are permanent residents. By the end of the season, the bed didn't look as neat as the day I built it. The boards had weathered a bit, the mulch was thinner, and the soil surface was scattered with the fallen leaves of spent plants. But to me, it looked better. Lived in, productive, and ready for another round. The soil had settled, as it always does, so I topped it off with a fresh layer of compost before winter. That way, it could rest and recharge while I planned for spring. The biggest lesson wasn't about soil chemistry, pest control, or even crop rotation. It was about the way a raised bed changes your relationship with your food. Growing in that 4x8 box didn't just feed my family. It gave me confidence. I didn't have to wonder what was sprayed on the lettuce, or how far the tomatoes had traveled. I could step outside, pick dinner, and know it came from a space I'd built with my own hands. When the season ended and frost finally took the last of the greens, I stood there in the crisp morning air, looking at the bare bed. Instead of feeling like something was over, it felt like something permanent had started. This wasn't a one-time project. It was the beginning of a habit, a skill, and a little patch of security I could count on year after year.